Welcome back to The County Writes, The County Reads. I'm Lynn Pickering, and here's Anne Heathcote again, reading from Shadows in the Tree by Jennifer DeBruin.
Traitors! The screams of the men who jump from the rocks ahead of us on the trail break the silence in such a shocking manner that, though there are only three of them, their sound is deafening in the utter silence. I thrust the children behind me and ready myself for the fight I will mount in defense of my precious ones. As though we are of one thought, Elizabeth and Mr. Bernhardt take up positions at either side of me, each with knife in hand, and we create a protective barricade. Mr. Van Allen and the Mohawk rush to meet our attackers head on. "Die, you traitors!" yells the first man heading toward our group. "Liberty for America!" screams the next. But these two noisemakers are not the ones I fear most. The third man, not but a boy yet, has murder in his eyes, and in his silence shows a terrifying resolve. The first two men, seeming to believe their noise will set fear in our hearts, are quickly overwhelmed by the ferocity of defense by Mr. Van Allen, who has shot the first dead, and the second, who has been clubbed about the head by the fearsome weapon we saw the Mohawk carry upon our first night on the trail. It is most effective. The children, terrified by what they are witnessing, hold tightly to my skirt, shoving them away, knowing if I must fight, I cannot have them holding on to me. Jacob grabs my hand as I turn to push him back, and I struggle to free myself. The older Bernhardt boys thankfully drag him from me, though I hear him fight them. His screams are but noise in my head, and I cannot focus on these. Safeguarding the younger ones, I hear one of the boys say in a stern and commanding voice, "Come now, huddle here. Our mothers and father need to fight." Feeling my absolute right of defense of these children in this moment, that is exactly what I intend to do. The third attacker, with no regard for the loss of his companions, heads swiftly but silently in our direction as Mr. Van Allen and the Mohawk make sure the men they have subdued are, in fact, dead. We all raise our knives in unison. In reaching us, I can feel the warm breath and spit upon my face as he hisses, "Sir John has taken what I love most, and now I shall pay him back in kind and take his people from him." With the raising of his gun, I tighten my grip upon the handle of the knife and raise it to meet his onslaught. A sudden flash of buckskin appears in front of our eyes, and with strange gracefulness in his execution, the Mohawk silently takes him down. Seeming unreal, I cannot look away as the knife disappears into flesh. Despite the intervention, his motion carries him forward, and he falls upon me and Mr. Bernhardt, his blood covering us as he slumps at our feet. Standing close, but knowing his work is done, the Mohawk does not continue his attack. Sputtering blood from his mouth, hate lingers in the eyes of our attacker. Though he may have been a boy, tending fields, working along with his father at one time, hate had long ago killed that boy, and what now lay on the blood-soaked ground was the result. I have never seen a man killed before, nor would I have expected the relief in its outcome, but I cannot feel pity for one who would have taken away what I love most dearly.
That was Anne Heathcote reading from Shadows in the Tree by Jennifer DeBruin, my guest today on The County Writes, The County Reads. Jennifer, they've endured many hardships along the way, not only enemies jumping out from the bushes, but disease and starvation, really. Can you just give us a picture of what it was like for them traveling through the woods?
I think it's important to note that these families were leaving as they could be rescued. So there was no sort of pre-planning. You never knew when the knock on the door was going to come. And so they had to leave with next to nothing because you are running away from enemies. So in the case of Maria Katrina, she could leave with nothing but her children in tow because nobody's going to help her carry these little ones. So they had to make their way north with little. Their guides, although very knowledgeable, because often they were the Mohawk guides, knowledgeable about where they could access food along the way, they weren't carrying stores of food. And so as you would pick up Loyalist families, I mean, sometimes it was more than you could care for. Certainly shelter was really rudimentary along the way. It was damp. The time of year would have been cold, still had frost coming out of the ground, so you've got mud. Who knows the water that you're drinking? So it was treacherous. Never mind, we had a break in the Iroquois Alliance, and so we had other Native groups that were able to track you on the well-worn trails, so you had to hack your way through the bush. So, you know, even those trails would have made a difference in how arduous that trek was, and never mind that the rebels, so the Americans, would have also been looking out for Loyalists making their way north. The whole point being, you didn't want people to make safety. And that's true. There's museums around here that have the little items that people manage to get across with, one of them being a spoon and a fork. Mm-hmm. Imagine that. Mm-hmm. That's your whole life right there. Mm-hmm. So it was definitely a treacherous beyond, I can't imagine walking through the Adirondacks.
Yeah.
Even now. But back then, to know that you were being hunted from all sides and to have such terrible conditions, you wouldn't be used to that.
I'd like to talk a little bit about the role that the Native, the Iroquois, and the Mohawk played in the in helping the Loyalists. And can you just explain how that worked with those tribes?
Yeah, as I said, as my German Palatines tried to stay neutral, so did many of the Iroquois Alliance, and so that was Six Nations. Eventually, you couldn't be neutral. You were enemy, or you claimed your allegiance to the American cause. And so the Mohawks aligned with the British cause and became Loyalists. So truthfully, without the help of Mohawk guides and Mohawk warriors, I certainly wouldn't be sitting here today. And I think it's important to recognize that contribution, because we know so much of the history around it, but I think the individuals that they saved to get them north is an important part of that. So where they would have known the well-worn trails north, they also knew how to get off those trails and to make sure that these families would survive. I mean, there's even instances where they would, teach them to take the roots from the ground. And so these people had to learn to forage as the First Nations people did.
Mm-hmm. So. On arrival, when they did get to Quebec, mm-hmm. they were kept in refugee camps.
Yes. There was no land ready for them. In fact, where my ancestors settled along the St. Lawrence River near Cornwall, that wasn't surveyed at all. That was Mohawk land. And so there was nothing west of there for them to settle on. And certainly the outcome of the war hadn't been decided yet. So some were coming up into refugee camps prior to the signing of the Treaty of Paris that ended the war in 1783. And then when the ones that had stayed till the end realized that they had to go north, it was the refugee camps that welcomed them. Canvas tents and sometimes wooden barracks, but again, very rudimentary lodgings for them.
I'd like to ask about your ancestors and the research you did, because the name of your characters are your ancestors.
Right. Yeah.
So how did you go about researching into your family background?
Well, I've been doing genealogy for a lot of years, and I think, it's interesting to note how much is actually accessible if you know how to get around it. So Library and Archives Canada has a wonderful collection that is available online. And so when you read what's called an Upper Canada Land Petition, so that's when they were trying to claim land as reward for their loyalty to resettle their families, sometimes it would lay out the story of, this soldier and what had happened to his family in the regiment. And even in my own family, if there wasn't a well-documented story to it, I would just look at who else was in his regiment and what they were saying. So I could get around maybe not having primary documentation for my own ancestors, but rather reading the diaries of others. I do know for Maria Katrina, in fact, there was a document that lists her as a refugee when she arrived in Montreal, which is just, when I found that, I was sort of shocked to see that name given to somebody I'm descended from.
Mm-hmm. Why did you want to write the book from her viewpoint?
Well, I think most people that, you know, are amateur genealogists will very quickly realize that women are question marks, the mother of, the wife of, the daughter of. Their story is very often hidden in history, but very often, you know, there's just no mention of them whatsoever. Somehow these families descend from the soldiers, and those are great tales that are told and interesting, but there was moms there too, and there was women that had to assume roles that were not natural to them in that period of time, and certainly had to become the warriors of their children's fates. So I felt that it was important to focus on the women, despite telling the story of a family. I mean, certainly it's still the story of a family, but to honor them, because, you know, it was a man and a woman who stood side by side and created the foundation of the life I get to live.
In September 2013, you received your United Empire Loyalist Certificate declaring you a descendant of Peter Emer. Why was that important to you?
Well, particularly for Peter Emer, my mother's maiden name is Emer, and my grandfather's, I guess, melancholy when talking about his descendancy, I felt I was honoring him in doing that. And I thought it was important to connect myself to this big history to say, yes, I belong to these people as much as I do to any of my ancestors, but the United Empire Loyalist Association of Canada gives you that unique opportunity to be able to have something that certifies you as a proven descendant of the American Revolution and of people who not only were refugees once, but twice, and in some cases three times in my family's sake. So I felt it was important to honor their sacrifice.
You were speaking today at the museum here in Picton, and a lot of people spoke to you afterwards. What were they asking you or speaking about?
Well, in a lot of cases, they weren't necessarily asking me questions. They would say, I'm descended from a loyalist, and thank you so much. I was moved, or that was so impacting, and it's so nice to hear the story of who I'm descended from told. In some cases, they would ask me if I could help them make connections or how I found those connections, because particularly with women, or if you're not a famous soldier, it can be a little bit difficult to get around and find those. But you know, time and again, I am so impressed that people want to connect themselves to their ancestors and that they understand that there's value in reflecting on who we've come from and where we've come from so that we can carry those lessons forward. And to me, that's what legacy is. It's a living thing. It's a continuous thing.
Well, thanks very much for speaking to me today.
Thank you so much, Lynn.
Jennifer DeBruin is the author of Shadows in the Tree, plus other books based on true events. To learn more about them, go to Jennifer's website, jenniferdebruin.com. And you can also reach her through her Facebook page, Jennifer DeBruin, author. Stay with The County Writes, The County Reads when we come back. Christine Renault has been curled up with some good books this month. She'll tell us all about them in Christine's book report. That's next on 99.3 County FM, the voice of the county.